wait to hear the speaker. And then then she said my name. And but how great is this? How great is this? Come on. I mean, how really great, right? Like, I look out at everybody. I've been wandering around here full of gratitude the last couple of days for many, many reasons. But I was thinking, I talked about it this morning at the luncheon. Any one of these tables, right? How many people here in their first year of sobriety? Raise your hand. All right. So your life and the lives of people who love you have gotten better this year, right? Right? Or you're all like, oh yeah, my mom says so, right? But and all these tables full of people who are in recovery, who've been working the 12 steps and changing and having a psychic change and looking at the world from a different point of view. Think of all the lives we touched, all the responsibilities we have, all the people that we love, and all the people that love us. Now, how great is this? I mean, I get goosebumps talking about you. That's pretty cool. I was in the depths of the bondage of self. You know, I actually would love to come up here and just talk about recovery. But a good friend of mine, Patty O, whose son is sitting right over there, took me aside one time and said, Matthew, you got to talk about alcoholism so they trust that you recovered. And that's challenging because I'm on fire for this thing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not my life. My life is my life. I'm in love with my wife. I have four children that just dazzle me. Well, three and a half. And I like my job. I like my dog, Delilah. I do all sorts of fun stuff all day long. But AA is my way of life. And sometimes I think people get the wrong impression when people get up here and talk about their program and they're like, God, all that guy does is AA. There's no oil paintings of Bill Wilson in my house, right? It's not that kind of house. Yeah. In fact, one time I was speaking in Akron, Ohio, and they made me a blanket of the first edition, like the red and yellow thing. They knitted this thing. And on the way to the airport, my daughter, who was 12, goes, Mom's not going to want that in the house, Dad. And she jumped out of the cab and wrapped it around a homeless guy. Yeah. How great is that? There's some homeless guy in Akron with the first edition wrapped around himself. And they're like, hey, that was the speaker gift, you know. True story, sorry. It says in the 12 step, in the 12 and 12, the first sentence, the joy of living is the theme of AA's 12 step. I would say of all of these steps. And action is its key word. But I'll tell you, I got sober on May 16th, 1993. And when I look at my life and I look at alcoholism and what happened in my family and all that, I think I liked my life, you know? I grew up in Redondo Beach in the 70s and 80s. Yeah, it was a weird existence. I went to Catholic school, and you could see the beach from my school. The sexual revolution had happened. The bikinis were getting so much smaller. And I had these nuns staring at me all day long, you know. It's very disconcerting. And it was weird, you know, but I love my parents. I'm not one of those guys that hated his parents. I love my brothers and sister. I like my friends. My mother bought me a guitar when I was kind of awkward guy. I was covered with acne and I couldn't throw a ball to save my life. I didn't care to. When I was in seventh grade, my mother brought me a guitar, and I loved that, and I was around musicians, and I worked at the Redondo Pier. I had a good life, you know? And then as you go into early adulthood, there's a line in the big book, in the 12 and 12, that says, this deadly business of living alone with our conflicts. And I think about that baggage that I started to carry into young adulthood, and like this God that was really impressed upon me by the witches of God, by the nuns, you know, and my parents. It's all right, Sister B said I can say that, but my parents were into it, but I never felt like I was good enough for that God. I wasn't. I really wasn't, but I tried. I wanted to be. I went even to a little spell at the seminary. I was thinking about being a priest. And when I was 14, a nun looked at me. Well, she probably looked at a lot of people, but I'm selfish and self-centered. And she looked at me in eighth grade, and she said, you know, if you're even thinking about sex, you're going to hell. And I was like, uh-oh. Yeah, you know. It's like, you know, yesterday when I was brushing my teeth, I forgot to think about sex for a few minutes. But I got right back on it, right? And I never did it and thought I never probably would, but I thought about it all the time because I was 14. And then I went outside thinking, I'm going to hell. Like, and I'm not kidding. And then I looked at all my friends and go, well, it's going to be crowded. You know. And then by the time I got here, I probably was going to hell. And I did a bunch of stuff I didn't think I'd do. And I carried this stuff into adulthood. I had this baggage, you know. I didn't feel like that God that they described. I thought he didn't, probably didn't like me, you know, from the way I acted. And I had it made. I played guitar. I dated the head cheerleader at my high school, right? Thank God, Mom, for that guitar, right? And I remember this football player was cramming me in my locker one day. And he said, why is she going out with you? And I go, because I'm sensitive, you idiot, you know. But I mean, I was president of the school. I dated the head cheerleader. And I just wish I knew what you guys knew. I couldn't figure out what you all knew. And I didn't know I was carrying that stuff around. And I don't know if that's what makes me alcoholic. But this deadly business of living alone with our conflicts, right? And my brother, I'm the youngest of four in an Irish Catholic family. My next brother above me is 7 years older. It's a little bit of a surprise. My brother above, that's 2 years older than him, 2 years older. My parents were like, oh my God, we have another baby, right? Also a great place to grow up in the bosom of my family, like just surrounded by love and stories and music. It was awesome. But my older brother, who was my hero, the one right above me, 7 years older, was a terrible drunk by the time he was 14. So unlike the rest of you fashionable new age alcoholics, I didn't start drinking in high school. I didn't start drinking when I was 10 or 12 years old. You guys want to get that? Okay, good. But I did drink once, but I didn't because I didn't want to be like my brother. I like my parents, and he was bringing all this darkness on our house, and he would borrow my surfboard to go surfing and sell it at the beach, you know, like that kind of stuff. And but all sorts of other stuff that was really dark and awful, and I'd hear him screaming at my parents at night, and I'm laying in the bedroom going, what is his problem, man? So I didn't drink, and there was a time when I was in high school when he was homeless. And people didn't know about my house and what was happening at my house. And I had these five friends I grew up with, really close buddies. I just played poker with them a few weeks ago. We're really close since kindergarten. And I went over to their house. I'm not an athlete. I don't drink. They're all drinking a little beer here and there. But I'm one of them, right? But I'm full of all this, like, fear and, like, I'm not good enough. Even that girl who dated me, lovely girl, I wasn't good enough. But why did she date me? And it's all good things are happening. And my brother's homeless. He lives in his car. And I feel like I got acne from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. And I weighed 120 pounds, but I still felt like eighth grade when I weighed 80, you know. I was just like not one of them. And they were taking tequila shots. And I couldn't take it anymore. It wasn't about the alcohol. I just couldn't take being separate. And I asked if I could have a shot of tequila. And these were good guys. There was no pressure. And one of them, I don't know, Casey, I think, is a big, beautiful house overlooking the ocean in Hermosa Beach. A long time Hermosa Beach family, one of the early founders there. Like, their names are on the pier. They were early surfers. And I think it was Casey said, hey, Mitch, you know, this is tequila. And I was like, okay, whatever. And I took a shot of tequila. And only you guys know what happened, right? It just went, hit my chest. Just warmth came over me. 12 years of Catholic school guilt melted out of my shoulders. My acne went. And I was like, give me a ball, quick, you know. I can throw that thing. I know I can. And And you know, it was one shot. Now, I don't know if that deadly business of living alone with my inner conflicts was just put assuaged for a while. I don't know. I don't know what happened. I just know I went, oh my God, this is why my brother does this. And he lived in his car. And I asked for more. I got a much larger glass because, you know, didn't want to make too many trips. And they gave me, they're like, hey, this is tequila. Like, kept saying that like that meant something. Like, okay. And I got the tequila, and it was helping. It was really helping, quite therapeutic. And I was thinking, I think I will be a priest. All sorts of great ideas are coming into my head, you know. And I'll dump the head cheerleader. And I'm walking down the hall of this big house. They had seven brothers and sisters. All my friends were big Irish Catholic families. And there was a bathroom in there. And I went in there. I had to go to the bathroom. And it's just crazy. Now the room's spinning, and I don't know why. And I'm sitting on the toilet. And I remember, this is a true story, my last thought before I blacked out was, God would not make a body that could defecate and vomit at the same time. Because Sister Dennis Ann said God was perfect. And some of you know I was wrong about that, right? I could tell the first time how many of you know. But I woke up laying in this is the weirdest part of this story. The next morning, I woke up in a sleeping bag with a pillow under my head in the bathroom and smelled like bleach. Didn't know why. Yeah. There's seven bedrooms in this house, and I'm sleeping in the bathroom, and I'm like, this is weird. And I got that furry tongue tequila feeling, you know, and they're all gone. Nobody's there. And so I went downstairs. I got my bike. I could have bought a car when I was in high school, but I bought like 10 guitars instead. So I rode my bike home to school, and halfway to school, I remembered what had happened. And these guys found me laying on the floor of the bathroom, you know, in between functions. And they cleaned me up, and I just went, God, man, I was cool for like 15 minutes. And I blew it, right? And I was so humiliated. And I went to school, and they didn't say anything. They didn't mention it. In fact, Casey one time listened to a talk that I gave, and I talked about my first drink, and he goes, Jesus, Mitch, if we knew what's going to happen, we would have never gave you that shot of tequila. You know, but what happens later? But I didn't drink again. And I've been to 1,000 of these conferences, and I've heard people say, I got drunk, I got in a fight, I got arrested, I puked on my mom, and I woke up, and I couldn't wait to do it again. That was not me. I was like, I'm not going to be my brother. You know, I can't really tell you his story. It was horrible. And it was really hard to watch a guy I loved and respected so much go through all that. And just a little aside, there's a lot of people here that I love and respect. I want to say hi to Shane and Pat O and Carol, who did one of your meetings, your marathon meetings, and my friend David came out. And there's so many people here that are just admirable people. And my brother was my hero, right? He's my older brother. He played the drums. He looked like Paul McCartney. He had that beard, like the Let It Be beard with the long hair. Anyone? All right. I'm not that old, but, you know, and he destroyed everything. He destroyed all the harmony, destroyed all the peace. One of the things it says in the 12-step, in the 12 and 12, I was reading it to Julia today, is here we experience the kind of giving that asks no rewards. Here we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. You know, but when we're drinking, nobody gets emotional sobriety. Nobody around us, right? And my brother just kind of robbed us of that. So when I had that experience with my friends, I decided I'm not doing that again. I was humiliated. That was one reason, but I just didn't want to do it again. And just before I went to college, my brother came home. He had like 3 months of sobriety. He was going to the Treasures. He's couch surfing. He was living in his car a little bit, and he came to the front door and said, I haven't had a drink in 90 days. Can I take a shower? And it was like the prodigal son. My dad was so happy. My dad named my brother Neil after his father Cornelius. And my grandfather Cornelius died of alcoholism in 1945 after Bill Wilson 12-stepped him. So this thing goes deep with us. And my dad was like, he's back. And I disappeared. I got straight A's. I was class president. I played in a ripping band. I got accepted to all the colleges I wanted to go to. And I disappeared. And my brother, who blotted out the sun, came through the door. And he did weird stuff he'd never done before. Like he told the truth. That was weird. It was. We would go to church together, right? He and I would go to church together. On the way home, he'd be talking to me. He'd walk in, and my mom would go, how was church? And he goes, I don't know. We went to the beach. Church is better, buddy. You know, she wanted us to go to church. He just lied all the time. And I didn't know why until I lied all the time. And I wasn't mad at him. I was really glad for him. I was really happy. In fact, I remember I was standing in our bathroom once, brushing my teeth. We have no privacy in our family. And my brother's in the bathtub. He's been living with us about 2 weeks. And he's reading this blue book. And I remember looking at him thinking, what's in that blue book that we didn't try? We did group therapy. You take Irish people to group therapy, it's a silence. It's like this quiet game. Let's play the quiet game. You know, like my sister says, we're Irish Catholic. If there's an elephant in the living room, we turn it into a coffee table. Nobody says anything, right? But my brother's sitting there reading the big book. I didn't know that. I just knew he was nice. I knew he didn't take a swing at my dad at night. I knew he didn't steal my surfboard. He was this tender, like quietly loving guy. It says he finds himself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love, which he thought himself quite incapable. And he was just a little ways into this thing. So I went off to college. I went to Chico State, where the motto is, I think I went to Chico State, right? And I forgot I didn't drink. I forgot I didn't do a whole bunch of other stuff too, but that's for a different program, right? But I'm a drinker, I'm an alcoholic. So I'm gonna fast forward from going to college and starting drinking to May of 1993, because I want to talk about recovery. I ended up getting 2 degrees and graduating at the top of my class. I have a degree in English and a degree in religious studies. Super useful if you want to be like a doorman or something. But I just loved college. I loved learning. I went to Chico State. There were 3 girls to every guy, and I played in the most popular band in town. It wasn't bad. I loved it. I loved my professors. I thought about being a professor. And then as soon as I graduated, I was playing in a pretty good band there. We're recording a little bit. And then I went to do a trip to the East Coast and ended up going off with a band. I ended up touring with a band. And I lost that job. I lost the best job I ever had from drinking too much. And I think sometimes if I had to do like a 10-minute pitch, I could come up and go, okay, what it was like, I got thrown out of a rock and roll band for drinking too much. That's hard to do. The bar is low, 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 right? But I'd wake up every morning and crawl under it, you know? Because I just was, you know, and I look back on that, and there's all sorts of funny things that's happened, and there's all sorts of really sad, sick thing that's happened. But the worst part is I worked all my life for that dream, and I blew it. Repeatedly, you don't get kicked out for one bad thing. I blew it. I came back to California, I lied. I said I came back because my mom was dying of cancer. I lied all the time about everything by then. Because that's the other thing they talk about is physical, moral, and spiritual bankruptcy. So the thing about alcoholism is it's a slow, ugly progression. I was a happy guy. I liked my life. I was grateful for my family. I liked my talent. I liked my opportunities. But then I started drinking. And slowly over time, I gave away so much. And I gave away things that other people would value. I gave away my opportunities with music. I gave away beautiful relationships with lovely people I respected and cared about. I gave away my integrity and my dignity. I gave away my ability to earn a living. And I just, each thing I had to surrender, I'm like, that's okay, I'll figure it out. And I was the guy that could pull it out at the last minute. I can't tell you how many finals I showed up to, hadn't done a damn thing, and got an A. I could do that, but I don't know about you, but when I kept poisoning myself with this stuff, I'd show up and I didn't have the faculties now. I'd show up standing in places I'm supposed to know what we're gonna play. I don't know what we're gonna play. I get these jobs I thought were too lame for me to take, and they'd fire me. I'm like, you can't fire me. This job's beneath me. You know? And they're like, well, you seem to be incapable of doing it, you know, and which is weird, I know. But the weird thing about that, like, I've seen this time and time again, and I lived it. I gave away everything that was valuable to me. I gave it up, surrendered it to keep doing this. And I became physically, morally, and spiritually bankrupt. Now, you ask a newcomer who just did all that to let go of some old ideas, and like, hey, whoa, man. I'm a thinker. I'm too smart for this God thing. It's like, dude, you gave away everything important to you. Everything. And I want you to be willing to believe something that you don't believe in, and you're refusing. Think about that. You know, surrender means to give up. Surrender is give up. One of the definitions for surrender is to yield to the power. Isn't that beautiful? And I thought about this the other day. I was up in the mountains last weekend with some AA guys, and give up. I was given down. I was like, okay, I'll give that to you, drugs and alcohol. I'll give that to you. I'll give that to you. I'm given down. And then I came here, and you just said, dude, give up. So what happened? What happened? In May of 1993, I couldn't get a job. I'd been unemployed for about 6 months or 7 months. My mom was dying of cancer. I didn't lie about that. I just lied that that's why I moved home. She lived a couple miles away with my father. My father and mother were married at that time for 45 years. They were married for 50 years to each other when they passed away. I am a blessed human being. I had it all. I'd been fired from this job managing a restaurant, and one of the waitresses in May of 1993 was 8.5 months pregnant with my child. She was 18 years old, and I was 31. Okay, whatever. You're going to judge me now? Like, I'm in an AA conference, you know. This is the what it was like part. Like, God. Yeah, and it gets worse. But my thought was, my feeling was, she can't have a kid. She's selfish and self-centered. I really did think that, right? And I lived right next door to a liquor store, and my beautiful guitars just disappeared. Somebody would steal one. I'd take one to the pawn shop. I'd sell one for way less than it was worth, sometimes just to walk next door to the liquor store. And in May of 1993, nobody was coming in my house. Nobody was visiting me. If you came up on the porch, I lived on the second floor. If you came up on the porch I saw the shadow, I didn't answer the door. I don't want anyone to know. I'm not paying the rent. I'm not paying the bills. I'm sick. And every day, I don't want to drink. And if you're in your first year, this whole moonscape I made in my life has nothing to do with why I'm here talking to you about Alcoholics Anonymous. What it's about is that every day I woke up and thought, today I'm not going to drink. Because I didn't want to anymore. It made me feel terrible. It didn't get me where I needed to go. I knew the distance between the drink and the trouble had evaporated. There was just trouble in drinking. And every day I'd think, not today. And the way it worked for me, this is just an example. I can't remember this time very well. But I would get up and think, I'm not going to drink today. I'm going to do something positive. I'll clean my apartment. I'll try to get a job. I'll go see this teenage girl's parents and tell them that I'm a stand-up guy. I'll go see my mom. I love my mom. My mom changed everything for me. She was sensitive and quiet, watched me, bought me a guitar, got me a great guitar teacher. When I became a professional musician, my little depression-era mom called me up and used to say, how are your gigs, honey? It's so sweet. And I woke up and thought, I'll go see mom. And apparently I called her a lot and said, I'm coming to see you. And I probably meant it, but I never went. You remember that? You call and you go, I'm going to go. Then you're like, oh, what lie? What am I telling them? I don't look very good. Maybe I'll just settle down for a minute. And I get in the shower maybe that day, and the hot water would hit me, and I'd start to clean myself up. And I didn't take showers every day. And I'm cleaning myself up. And remember, you felt a little better, just a little better. And suddenly things aren't so bad. I think, well, I'll go see my mom. I'm going to go see my mom. I won't do any of that other stuff. Wow, I don't know what I told mom. I don't know how sick she is. I haven't seen her in a while. I'll go get a couple of beers next door. I won't get gin. I'll just get a couple of beers. And then I go next door, and I'm going to get a couple of beers. It's a couple of Fosters. I need it's Australian for breakfast. I need them ready now. And I go next door and I see how much two Fosters were and how much gin was, the rocket fuel gin. And I like gin because it got me there. And I buy the gin. I'll just go home and just have a little. Then I'll go see mom. I just need to, And by the time May rolled around, I'm so sick, I don't even know what I'm saying. My mom's dying nearby, and that poor girl, she came to my house, and she said, we need to go to the doctor. And I pushed her down a flight of stairs. I didn't want to hurt her. I really didn't. I have a real hard time talking about this. I didn't want to hurt that baby. But to be totally honest, I didn't have any feeling for them at all. I pretended I did sometimes, but I didn't. Because I was in that cloying, useless place of the bondage of self. And when you're in it, you don't even know it. I wouldn't have even known what that was. And I didn't go see what was wrong. What happened was, I just didn't want to go to the doctor. I'd been drinking all night. And she said, hey, maybe you should calm down a little bit. Maybe you shouldn't party today. And what I heard was she's screaming at me that I'm a bum. And she wasn't. And I grabbed her wrist, and I just wanted to get her out of the doorway. I hadn't said a word. I just answered the door. She said this perfectly normal thing, and I thought, I just go away. And I felt like I pushed her too hard, and I closed the door, and I went inside. So that's what I was like. After the slow progression of alcoholism, the slow, ugly progression of alcoholism, I was physically, morally, and spiritually bankrupt, and I had big, fat accounts before I took that drink. I had a great spiritual life. I had a great family life. I knew how to make money at the thing I loved the most in the world. But this slow progression, my friend Beth says, if alcohol took everything we loved in one swoop, we'd all run to AA and work the steps like our life depended on it. But alcohol takes a little bite, and we adjust down. And it takes another bite, and we adjust down. And pretty soon, we're living like pigs in the sty. And that was me. I was Gollum in my apartment. my precious. Someone's at the door. We don't answer the door. Okay, we won't answer the door. That was a good day, So what happened? May 8th of 1993, I don't get sober till the 16th, but May 8th of 1993 was Mother's Day. And my brother called me the day before. My brother, who lived in his car, was sober 12 years now in the Trudgers. No one knew what was wrong with me. No one guessed that I was an alcoholic. And my brother said, I'm going to come get you. Tomorrow's Mother's Day. It's probably your last Mother's Day. I don't want you to miss it. And I remember thinking, it's Mom's last Mother's Day. And he goes, I know you're having car trouble. I always think that's funny. I always tell this part of the story. My car trouble was I had a key to a car. There was this great big mechanism that went on the other end, and I hadn't seen it in a really long time. And in an Irish family, that's, you're having car trouble. It's cool. We'll come get you. Nobody wants to embarrass you, right? And he said, I just want to make sure you'll show up. And he hangs up. So I'm already mad. Why would he think I'm not going to show up? I didn't know I called. I didn't know I was calling. And he said, I'll come get you tomorrow, and I'm going to make a card. I'm going to get flowers. I'm going to take a shower. I'm going to overwhelm my beautiful mother, Dorothy Mitchell, with love and kindness. And I sat down, and I started drinking gin, and he honked his horn. I hadn't slept. I hadn't changed my clothes in 3 days. And I'll just suffice it to say I ruined Mother's Day. The thing about alcoholism that's so painful is people who are trying to love us, we don't care about at all. And people we're trying to love, we just hurt them. Or at least I should say, that's what I did. If I was your friend, I was a problem. If I was in your family, I broke your heart. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't even think in those terms. But I ruined Mother's Day, and through a series of events, my brother came back to my house after he dropped me off, and he 12-stepped me, in the most beautiful way, you know? Sometimes you don't know what's setting in motion the grace of God. And by the way, I have a well-tested theory about the grace of God. I'll probably get to that in a second. So I called, my brother left me at my house. We were screaming at each other. By the time he got home, I called him up and wanted to finish the argument. So I started screaming at him again. I'm like, how dare you? What was my higher ground? I just ruined Mother's Day, right? But you know, we're just arrogant. And I'm yelling at him and screaming at him. And I don't know what came out of my mouth. And he's just listening. And when I finally got quiet, there was just this pause. And I looked down at the carpet. And my brother said really quietly, Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. Now, that wasn't the grace. I had that many, many times. But out of my mouth, and I didn't even know I was going to say it, I said, of course I do. Bill says in Bill's story, when I made that surrender, like everything changed, right? And I can't tell you like light hit me or anything like that, but I didn't think I was about to do that. And I realize now I worked the first step. The first step, second word is admitted. I surrendered it to you. I've been denying it. Now I'm admitting it. And I said to him, of course I do. And I can tell you today what the phone felt like in my hand and what the little dust mites from the Venetian blinds, you know, the way that light hits those, that dust and the slats, the green shag carpet, the beige phone with the cord on it, the gin bottles on the floor. I could relive that moment. And I know why now. It took me years to figure out, like, why is that seared into my memory? Because I stepped into the present moment, the only place this power is going to meet me, the only place it's available, never shows up here. It shows up here. And my brother said the funniest thing. He goes, don't go anywhere. And I said, oh, okay, yeah. I was going to move to that end of the couch in the fall. But if you're coming over, you know. And he came flying over, and my brother got there in record time, and he came bursting through the door. And I didn't know why. Like, why did my brother speed? When he was leaving, I was kind of like this, you know. Now he's like, I can't wait to get back, you know. And he comes running through my door, and I know now why, and I didn't know. I didn't know. He heard, and all of you in your first year, he heard the most precious thing available to us, willingness. And sadly, it's a small window sometimes. And he wanted to get there before it slammed shut. And he came in my house and he took me down to the beach and he told me how he felt when he was living in his car. He told me a little bit about himself and he won my confidence. And I sat there listening to him and I ran out of cigarettes and he kept talking. So I go, okay. And honestly, the truth of it was, he was clear-eyed. He was calm. He told the truth. He loved my mother. He went over to visit her all the time. He had a good job. My brother was so obnoxiously sober, he bought a house that had 12 steps to the front door. Like, you know. He's like, hey, smoking cigarettes, there's 12 steps to the front door. I'm like, so what? Yeah. But you know what's great about that is my brother, he had a lot of, you know, history kind of knocking me around. I remember once I wouldn't lend him my bike because he sold stuff that I lent him. And I wouldn't lend him my bike. And he goes all mad at me. And then I lent the neighbor my bike because he had a paper route and he's got a flat tire. And my brother beat me up to show that family comes first, you know. Family comes first. You know, I was like, I got it. Right? But he didn't do that. He came over and he saw one alcoholic dying of alcoholism, and he was armed with certain facts about himself. And I'm pretty passionate about this because I love AA. I've been to 7 countries for AA. I've been to 50 states for AA. And I've heard people from these podiums go, and then my sponsor thumped me out in the chest and called me stupid. And I got to tell you, man, I've read this book 10,000 times. There's no place in here that says to do that. There's several places in here that say, whatever you do, don't do that. We never talk down to another alcoholic. Love and tolerance of our code. It's not we never talk down to them unless they have stupid ideas. We always have stupid ideas, right? Like my sponsor says, when they come over and said, I met the stripper of my dreams, we're getting married. You go to the wedding. So my brother did this beautiful thing, and I said, okay, I'll go to AA. And he laughed, and he goes, AA, you're not going to AA. I go, what? And he goes, you're going to the hospital. I weighed 108 pounds. Yeah, I weigh 170 pounds now. And he goes, you're going to the hospital. And I said, how long? And he goes, 30 days. And I go, yeah, I'm a little busy. Anybody too busy for rehab? Right, right. You know, I'm the guy not paying my bills. I'm not going to work. Who's going to not do those things if I'm not here? Like, I always think, like, what was I too busy doing? Hiding on my couch talking to myself? Like, there's going to be a hole in the universe if I leave, you know. So he said, hey, man, I'm going to come get you. It's going to take a little while to figure this out. And I hadn't agreed to the hospital, right? But I did a little surrender. I did this little surrender. And what I've noticed, this is just observation. This isn't a theory. Surrender, grace. Little tiny surrender, grace. Surrender, grace, love. So I made this little surrender, immediately regretted it, because he's gone now. Mother's Day's fading into the background, and I'm taking a shower. Things are good, right? And then he says, I'm going to be there on the 16th. We're going to take you over to Mom's and Dad's. They're going to take you to a hospital right near here. And I said, okay. So on the 15th, I got ready for the hospital. I drank as much alcohol as I could. Like, I didn't want to show up and not represent. You know, I'm a certain kind of specimen. I take my temperature. This is it. This is me, right? And actually, I was just afraid. I was terrified. I didn't know that. You don't even know. When you're in the bondage of self, you're afraid all the time, or you're pissed off, right? Which is just fear in reverse. And I woke up. I fell asleep. I fell asleep standing up. And I hit my head on the wall, and I was laying there, and I fall in a big gulp. I still don't know where that big gulp came from. 7-Eleven was miles away. I never left the house, but it was there. You remember the Martian things that people drop by, the Martians? I didn't have that yesterday. Or I had a bunch of shit in my apartment the other day, and that's all gone. This is the Martians, right? I'm laying on this big gulp, and the phone rings. I pick up the phone, and I thought it was my brother, and it was this woman who said, your baby was born. Can you get to the hospital? And I got in the car, and I went to the wrong hospital. Yeah, I'm selfish and self-centered. I went to the hospital where I was born. I did. That's where babies come from, man. I know this. And I went outside and I put my head in the steering wheel and I started sobbing because I was so afraid. I don't want to meet that baby. I don't want to go to rehab. And I'm such a loser. I'm in the wrong frickin' place again. And my roommate that was subletting the apartment, he'd moved to Mexico. He had a gun in the apartment. And I used to put bullets in it and stand in front of the open window and pray for courage because I was such a loser. And I knew now I could do it. I knew I could do it. I'm going to go home and shoot myself. And I got in the car and I put my head on the steering wheel and I turned at this AMC. They don't make them anymore for really good reason. And I turned the ignition and the steering wheel, the car backfired and the steering wheel, my head bounced up and the name of the hospital came into my head. That's the grace of God. It is. If I told you right now, don't think about Kansas, you're all thinking about Kansas, right? If I told you to think about something, like anything that comes into your head, random stuff comes into your head. I've studied neurology. I work for a biotech company. That thought came out of nowhere. I didn't think it. I wasn't trying to think it. That's a little surrender, a lot of grace. And I got in my car and I drove to the right hospital. I didn't go shoot myself. And I ran up the stairs to see this baby. And I'm running around and I'm trying to find the room. And I don't know who came up with the numeric system for hospital rooms. They don't make any sense. And I'm running around and I'm not thinking. You know, I got to see the baby. And I'm not thinking. And I run into the room and there's Anna. And I look at her and I remember the last time I saw her, she had terror in her eyes because she was falling down a flight of stairs. And she looks up at me, and she was glad to see me. And I immediately wanted to disappear into the floor. And if you've ever seen a woman that's had a baby, she had this curly Irish hair, red hair. It's matted to her face. She has like this neck that looks like the tree trunk. She has like, her breasts are like, she walks like the elephant man. I'm just reporting facts, right? And she's coming towards me, and I don't love her. I don't even like her. And she's coming at me, and I realize she's never been more beautiful. And I'm ashamed. I don't belong with this. I don't want her to touch me. And she didn't. She reached into a box. She pulled out an angel of God named Phoebe Rose. And she handed Phoebe to me, and Phoebe was more stunning and more pure and more radiant than Anna ever was. And she disgusted me. Because I'm in the bondage of self. And all I can see is how you reflect on me. All I can feel is what this means about me. And all my sins came back. All my horrible things. I've told you guys a little bit. And I realized I can't be with these people. They're good. And I lied. I said to Anna, everything's going to be all right. And I handed Phoebe back to Anna. And I lied. I knew what was going to happen. In 10 minutes, I'm going to blow my brains out. And it's the best thing I can do for you. And I prayed. I ran down the stairs and prayed, God, please make it so that I never see these women again. Because I'm going to do something stupid. And I'm racing home, trying to keep the courage up, trying to keep my, you know, I'm going to do it because I'm not going to mess this up. They live in a place where good things happen. I don't belong there. I'm morally, spiritually, and physically bankrupt. And I run up the stairs to my apartment, and my brother's standing there. Grace. I made a little surrender on the beach, and grace came. And he said, get in the car. My sponsor says that's the most spiritual sentence in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I was like. That's what happened. And now in half an hour, I'm supposed to tell you all the amazing things. But when you're new, like, oh, I mentioned the slow, ugly progression of alcoholism. There's a slow, beautiful progression of recovery. Thank God, because I get bored easily, right? And I'm 28 years sober, and it keeps getting better. It keeps getting better in more and more subtle ways. More beautiful things happen. I'm hopefully going to tell you about a couple of them. But that's not how I felt when I got out of the hospital, right? 30 days sober, I gained 47 pounds, so I'm robust now, right? I remember there's an old-timer said at a meeting once, Rotten Ron was this guy's name, and he used to chew on toothpicks and say these pithy things, you know. And he'd go, you know, some of you guys come in here at 90 miles an hour. You skid for a while. And I think that's what happened in the hospital. I think I just skidded through it. I think I ate, slept, and I got out of there. I had no idea what was going on. But I kind of liked being sober. I like 30 days. I like being healthy. So my brother drops me off at my apartment. He says, go to a meeting. I lie and go, that's what I'm going to do. And as soon as he drives away, I'm like, why would I? I just spent 30 days in the hospital. UAA guys are a little intense. You know, it's like, I don't really need a meeting. I just got out of the rehab. I need to see my child and my mother, and I need to do my laundry, and I need to get a job, and I got to cure cancer. I got a list of stuff, you know. And I walked into my apartment. Somebody handed me a beer. It wasn't a beer. It was a Coors. And that never gets old. And I looked at those people, and there were girls in bikinis snorting cocaine off my glass table. There was loud music playing through what was left of my stereo. There was pot smoke in the air and a beer in my hand, and I backed up and put that beer and I ran away. And I'll tell you why. One of those thoughts again. I looked at all my favorite Olympic events, and into my head comes, man, you got nothing. You don't have self-respect or character. You got no prospects. You owe everybody money. You're in trouble with the law. You're in trouble with the IRS. But you got 30 days. And the only thing, honestly, this is so true, this thought, the only thing I could sign my name under and say, that belongs to me, was 30 days. So if you're here in your first year, I want you to applaud right now for the one precious thing you got. And that's how much time you got. And I ran to a payphone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And then when I got done telling the guy pretty much everything I've told you so far, because I wanted, you know, him to understand my intricate problems. And he said, "Hey, man, where are you?" And I told him where I was. And he goes, "You're not going to believe this. There's a meeting right across the street from where you're standing. And it starts in 15 minutes. Grace, grace, grace. What I was going to tell you is not my theory. It's everywhere. It's all the time. It never stops. The reason we don't feel it sometimes is we revert back to the bondage of self. Now, I actually said to the guy, "What do you think I should do?" I'm like, "That's cool, your meeting, but I kind of explained. I got, like, real problems, you know?" And he's like, "Go to the meeting? You know, why'd you call AA, dude?" And I went to the meeting, so I ended up not lying to my brother. And I didn't feel good, but I didn't feel scared. I didn't feel like it. I knew nothing was going to happen sitting there. And when it was over, I didn't know where to go. And I got up and started to walk out, and a guy came over and said, "Hey, aren't you Neil's little brother?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "You need a ride home." And I said, "Yeah, but I can't go home." And he goes, "Well, I'll take you to your folks' house." And I go, "No, man." And if you're new, I had a perception of what that would be like. I perceived that I would go there, and my parents, who've been married for 45 years and are madly in love, it's going to have their loser son show up on their porch. It's going to be humiliating for them. It's going to be upsetting for them. It's not going to fit into their life like it is now. It's going to be awful for me. It's humiliating for me. I mean, you know, I was playing in a band at CBGB's a year before that, and now I'm moving in with my parents. I don't think so. That's my perception. And this guy dropped me off at my parents' house, because you don't listen to newcomers, it turns out. And he knew where we lived, because my brother's group painted my parents' house when my mother was sick with cancer. It's everywhere. And I walked into that house, and they were glad to see me. Super glad. And I didn't know. I didn't know it was perfect. I didn't know that they were married for 45 years, that my mother was dying of cancer, that the one thing that they were worrying about and praying about and thinking about all day long just walked up and said, "Can you help me?" I've raised 4 children to adulthood in this program, and it's my favorite sentence: "Dad, can you help me?" I didn't know. We don't know. My brain is not, the perception thing and the reality thing are divorced from each other. But that's because I'm in the bondage of self. So let's talk about getting rid of the bondage of self, right? The second step, came to believe. Hey, to all you newcomers, it doesn't say, then my sponsor read "we agnostics" at me till I surrendered and said, "Okay, I believe." It says we came to believe, right? And I got up that morning at my parents' house the next day, and I was like, "Holy God, I live at my parents' house." And I went out, I had a little meeting directory. I go, "Dad, can I go to the meeting? I don't want to be with them. They make me nervous. They're walking around being normal." It's very hard for a guy like me to be in that kind of environment. And I'm like, "There's a meeting." And he's like, "Take the car, man. Don't ask." So I go to the meeting to get away from them. And then it's you. And I don't know you, and you're weird. "Oh, come here, come here. Oh my God, here. This is the worst cup of coffee you're ever going to drink. And we all love each other, you knew." Like, I hated it. I did. I went to the meeting to get away from them. And then you guys, after about an hour of you, I'm like, "Okay, I'm good. I'll go back to my parents." And then I get to there, and then I start to get edgy and fidgety. And I go, "Oh, God, you know." And they were fine, and you were fine. But I was in the bondage of self. And I went back and forth 3 meetings a day for a long time. And then this thing happened. I woke up one day and I heard my dad in the kitchen. My dad used to get up super early. He was so afraid of losing my mom. And he goes, "Hey," I thought, "I'm going to go help him make breakfast." And I went out there and he started talking to me about meeting my mom. I'd heard this story a million times. We're making eggs and I go get mom and I'm helping mom get down the hall. And I'm thinking, "God, I got the best parents, man. Look at this love." And I go, "Oh, 7:00, I got to get to the meeting because Cheryl goes to that meeting and she always speaks inappropriately about her sex life and I don't want to miss that." And, well, don't judge me. All of you have done something like that, right? It's attraction. And I get there, and Carol, she did not let me down. And then I go back home, hang out with my parents who are lovely, start getting lame jobs at night. You know, I go to 3 meetings a day, and things just, I didn't know it, but I came to believe. It just happened. Came to believe that a power greater than myself, all this love at my house, all this stuff going on with you guys, was restoring me. I didn't drive to the meeting like if I turn left or right, I'm dead. That's how it was before. If I go down there, I know who's down there. If I go down there, I know who's down there. I just got to go there. And pretty soon I'm bringing speaker tapes home to my parents. We're laughing at stuff. And it was lovely. And no, it was hard. My mom was really dying. It was not pleasant. But there was so much going on in there. There's so much intimacy here. There's so many things we never talk about, right? There's the steps. They transform me. The third step. Turn my will and my life over to the care of God. What the hell does that mean? You know, the Al-Anon speaker talked about it today. Great job. Like, what does that mean? Right? Well, I'll tell you. I'll hopefully give you some examples. I'll give you a really simple example. I was working and had these terrible jobs, and I told my sponsor, I said, you know, I love my daughter so much. He goes, really? And I sit down, and he goes, how much child support do you pay? And I'm like, no, I love her. Love. And he said, yeah, never mind. So I went home and I called her and I said, Anna, I said, how much, you know, I don't make much money. And she said, oh, just a percentage. She's so smart, so smart. And she said, just a percentage of your paycheck. And I paid that every 2 weeks. That's the third step. We didn't ever talk, go to court. I had to pay it every 2 weeks because I had no credit and I couldn't get a bank account. And all those banks got computers and started talking to each other state to state. And in about a year into that, I was playing with Phoebe and I'm like, baby doll, you're going to go off to college with your mom now, but I'm going to take you to your first day of kindergarten. And I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade. There's no man on earth who's ever going to love you as much as I love you. And she's banging her giant Irish head against me and grabbing my jowls, and we're laughing, and I'm like, I get to be your dad for the rest of my life. I'm going to buy you a car when you're 16. I'm going to pay for college. I didn't own a car, and I had $0 in the bank. I was paying back tens of thousands of dollars. And a year before that, I prayed to God that I never see him again, that I have the courage to blow my brains into my apartment wall. And it was a righteous prayer. And I came here and you were so disinterested in what I thought and so interested in what I did. And I did all these stupid things. That's the third step. Another third step is, you know, I was saying that prayer, relieve me of the bondage of self, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I, because that word, when I heard that, that when I was kneeling on my sponsor's floor and he said the prayer and I repeated it and said, relieve me of the bondage of self, I had a visceral reaction. I thought, God, I want that. Because I'm walking around in this deadly business of living alone with my conflicts. I'm in my head all the time. I got to categorize everybody if I walk into a room so I feel safe. I can't just walk into a room. I'm in the bondage of self all the time. Whatever you're doing has to reflect on me. I hated it as I didn't drink. It became like terror to me. Relieve me of the bondage of self. So I said to my sponsor, I'm saying this prayer, relieve me of the bondage of self. He goes, that's great. Why don't you help God relieve you of the bondage of self? And I was like, sometimes I was like, what is this guy, the Riddler? You know, it's like, what does that mean? You know, and I said, I don't understand. And he's smoking a cigar outside of the Hermosa Beach Monday Night Men's Stag. He goes, why don't you go do something nice for somebody and don't tell anyone? We couldn't quite see what was in it for me, actually. But I went in there, and we have a big group. And like a lot of groups, it said, is anybody visiting? And this guy raised his hand and said, I'm visiting from Australia. He says, I won't do this Australian accent, but I'm going to be here once a month. And I thought, I'll remember that guy's name. His name was Kevin. I'll remember his name next month. And I'll be relieved of the bondage of self, right? I'm just going to do this thing, right? I'm going to, this thing. 30 days later, he comes by. I go, it's Kevin. He walked in. He wore a suit. We don't wear suits there. Sorry to the Pacific group. But this guy came in a suit, and I was like, oh, that's Kevin. I remember him. I ran over and said, "Hey, Kevin, welcome back to the greatest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world." And he said, "What do you do for a living?" And I stacked newspapers on a loading dock. And I drove a delivery truck during the day with my 2 degrees. And I said, I was embarrassed. I mumbled what I did. And he said, "I'm really impressed that you remembered my name. Why don't you come to my office? Wear a suit. Bring your Department of Motor Vehicles." And he was vice president of an international airline. And I got my black suit, Trent, who always looks great in a black suit. But I had my styling newcomer brown hush puppy shoes. Remember, hush puppies are like the size of bricks, right? But I think no one will notice because the suit is so awesome, right? And I walk in, and he looks at my shoes and starts laughing. He's got this big apartment. He's got this big Century Boulevard thing. And then he turns to the human resources woman, who's this gorgeous Hawaiian girl. And she floats across the room to us, right? And she looks at my shoes. And now my shoes feel like they're giant clown shoes, right? And I'm like, "I don't even know what this job is. I don't even know why I came here." And she said, "Do you have your Department of Motor Vehicle readout?" And it was about this thick. I go, yeah, don't. I hope we're not going to go by that, you know. I got arrested 3 times for the same DUI. Yeah, I didn't pay the whole fine once. I didn't, because I used some of the money to buy beer, you know. And I was at a stoplight, and I dropped a cigarette in my lap, and I ran the stoplight right in front of a cop. And he's like, "There's a warrant now for your arrest." And so that's all in there in my resume. And she's looking at it. And she's looking at me. She doesn't ask me a single question. There's no interview. And I'm trying to hide my feet. And she goes, I'll be right back. And she goes next door to his office, right? I saw him go in that office. And I hear him through the wall. He's yelling at her, "He's not going to fly the damn planes. He's going to put people on them." And I got real relaxed all of a sudden. Yeah. And she comes in and she's like shaking. She goes, "We're going to hire you." And I'm like, "Damn right, you know." I did not. I was like, thank you. What is the job? You know, like, whatever it is, it's better than the stuff I'm doing. And I got this job working at the airline. They gave me a suit, and I was going home and taking care of my mom and dad. I'm going to 3 meetings a day. And you know, when you're new, you're like, I didn't know how I was going to get out from under. And if I had planned and schemed to do it, it wouldn't have happened. But I surrendered a little bit, and I thought about someone else. I got free from the bondage of self for 43 seconds, and grace came showering down on me. And then the love. Like, you start to hold your head up. You start to see people where they are. You start to think about them. Like the promises say, you lose interest in selfish things. I got to be able to buy a guitar on my way to work. And I wasn't going to tell this story, but I'm going to tell this story and get to something magnificent. But I went and got this guitar on my way to work. I'm leaving my mom and my dad. I'm going to my job. I stopped at Guitar Center. I bought this amazing Taylor single cutaway Dan Curry with a pickup. And if you play guitar, you're jealous of me now. But I got there and I was like so in love with this guitar. I got nobody outside of AA in my life except for Phoebe and Anna when I give her the check. And I go in there and I'm like, nobody trusts me at the airline because the vice president hired me. I'm not drinking. I'm not chasing women. I'm just working. I'm not the cool guy, which is great. I was always the cool guy. I always got fired. But I'm just looking at this guitar and I walk out to the bus stop and I'm lonely. I got that newcomer loneliness. It's just me, you know. Nobody cares that I bought a guitar. Nobody cares I got a driver's license. Nobody cares. And I just look at this. There's this woman standing there. It was an employee bus stop from British Airways. And I said, "Hey, can I show you this new guitar I just bought?" And she looked at me and she goes, "I don't look at strange men's guitars." She's from England, I guess. I don't know. Somewhere over there. And I'm like, "God, what a bitch. I'm not hitting on you." And so we get on the bus, and I realize she thinks I'm hitting on her. I really just want someone to go, "Man, that's a great guitar. You're cool. I bet you used to be someone," you know. And I got on the bus, and I'm like, "Oh, well." And she's smashed against me, and she has this book called Surprised by Joy by C.S. Lewis. The whole bus is packed, and she's all nervous now. And I said, "Hey, I've read that book." I wanted her to relax. Beautiful book about Christianity, by the way, Surprised by Joy. And we talk about God, and she doesn't believe in God, and God saved my life. So I'm like spitting on her about God saving my life, you know? And she's like, oh, God, I hate this. This is weird. And we get to the other end, and I'm like, God, she's so beautiful, and she's so open, and she's so elegant, and I'm calm. And to all the men in the room, you know, that's a spiritual awakening, right? I didn't start lying. I'm actually an astronaut. I just work here during the day. Yeah. This guitar, I play with the Beatles. So, all the people from... But I got off and said, hey, you know, I've really enjoyed this. Do you want to have dinner? And she's like, oh, right. Look at my guitar. I've read that book. I need to wait for this bus every day. She attacked me. And I liked me now. I've been doing this stuff. I've been paying child support. I'm driving people to meetings in my crappy car. I'm doing good things. And I just looked at her and said, oh, that's too bad. I think we missed something. No, though, is the complete answer. And I kind of pushed her back on her heels. And I went home to my dad, who was waiting up to talk about my mom. And I didn't think I could take it again. And I thought, I'll tell him about this girl. And I said, it was weird. I said, Dad, I met this woman and she felt like home. And he said, wow, son, tell me about that. And I told him about it. And he said, that's not over. And I go, oh, it's over. She was pretty, like, you know. And so I went back to work the next day, and I thought about her, you know, not like maybe 100 or 220 times, I don't know. And I raced to the bus stop to not see her, and she came to the early bus, and she tapped me on the shoulder, and she said, hey, I think I was rude to you last night. And I said, that's okay. And she said, I don't want to go out with you. And I said, you've been super clear about that. And, and she said, but I'll have coffee with you. And I go, okay. She goes, we got to miss the bus. And I go, okay. And we missed all the buses. And she proposed to me 2 weeks later. And we've been married for 25 years. Suckers! Yeah! Miracles! That's right! You know why? Because I'm transparent with my wife. I adore my wife. I think she's awesome. I don't lie to her. I'm enough. I've never been enough. I'm not only enough for her, way more importantly, I'm enough for me. I have a relationship with a higher power that's just mind-bending. We had a couple of kids ourselves. You know who the first people to the hospital were? Anna and Phoebe. You know who took Phoebe to her first day of first grade? This guy. Second grade, this guy. I cried every time. In fourth grade, she said, Dad, you're a little hard to take. Fourth grade. She goes, could you just wait outside? And I'm like, no, man. I'm in. I bought her a car. I put her through college. She's a nurse, and she's saving lives in Portland, Oregon right now. She's 28 years old. And you know, we've done amazing things, but I want to talk about two things really quickly. My wife and I had a wonderful life. For 5 years, we traveled all over the world. We had a couple of kids. My parents got to see us be together. My mother came to our wedding before she died. We had Sophie and Rory. We had all these AA friends. We had people living in the trailer, people sleeping on the couch. Pip's not in AA. She's like, bring it on, man. Nobody I've ever met lives like you live. I love this. And then I came home one day, and she was flat on the floor. She had a massive stroke. And she's paralyzed on her left side. And she had brain damage. And I didn't know what to do. And I got in an ambulance, and I went to the hospital, and they did an operation, and it failed. And I walked out into the hospital waiting room at 3:00 in the morning, and like maybe 30 guys from the Monday Night Men's Stag were sitting out there. And we did it together. I want to read something really fast. I'm going to tell you one last thing. Do I have one more story left? My son Rory wrote this for his college exam, his college essay. As a child, it's hard to understand why systems sometimes fail or break. As a child, it's hard to understand why your parents stop laughing. Shortly after the birth of my younger sister, my mother suffered from a severe stroke caused by a weak artery in her neck. After this, things were different.
My mother walked with a limp and had trouble reading books to us. My father walked like a ghost and forgot how to warmly hold his small children the way he used to so easily. I firmly believe that every time life pulls the earth out from under your feet, it sends a rope in after you. After my mother's stroke, friends of my father would come over during the week to help us out. And every Sunday night, they would have a men's AA meeting in my backyard. As a child, they became my family. They slowly brought laughter and love back into the house that had become so cold. They were the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they never left us. They gave me the right questions to ask of life and practical advice on how to navigate my way through it. They taught me that everybody is trying their best, so we must always be kind, honest, and forgiving. And their words have served me over and over again. It says in here, we begin to practice the 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that those about us may find emotional sobriety. I didn't know that was his experience. He sent me this to proofread. My daughter Sophie's, her essay was, where other dads would pick up their daughters and take them to tea parties, my dad took me to the hospital to visit Liver Mike. Where other dads built mother-in-law quarters above their garage, we had a guy named Barnyard Tim living in our Airstream trailer. And I read that to Bill, and he's like, it's all true! You guys, it's not my life. This is not my life. They're my life. Love is my life. It says in here, when the 12th step is seen in its full implication, it's really talking about the kind of love that has no price tag on it. When a man or a woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which he could not do on his unaided strength and resources. He has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. Okay, I've got 5 minutes and I'll be done. I said it's a way of life. I've learned so much being so close to AA for so long and having the benefit and the privilege of meeting lots of people all over the world. And one of the things I know is when I get cloudy and dark and there's things happening and I'm meditating, by the way, as my sponsor says, meditation is not extra credit. I meditate every day, twice a day, half an hour each time, have for 15 years changed everything in my life. But I know I still can't do it. I'm transparent with my sponsor. I'm serving others. But I was up in Washington. We moved to Washington. I was feeling really weird. And I knew something was wrong. And I was talking to my sponsor. And then this guy texted me and he said, or emailed me and said, hey, man, do you want to go to India? And I've always wanted to go to India. I've studied Hinduism, all the forms of Hinduism. And I have posters of I've had a map of India on my wall forever. And he goes, will you come to India? We're going to do the ego-smashing tour of India. We're going to go over there and be of service. And my wife had just said, hey, you're traveling a lot. The kids are getting older. You got to stop traveling so much. So I knew. I surrendered. I said, hey, babe, this thing's like 5 weeks in India, or no, 4 weeks. And I said, maybe when the kids are out of college, maybe when things are mellower, I could go do this. And she goes, let me see that. And I went in and took a shower, and I talked to my guys when I'm shaving. I'm in the bathroom a while in the morning. I got the sponsee's call because I got to get to work. And I come out, and she's like, hey, I bought you a ticket to India. I said, what? And she goes, how could I stop you? Listen to this. You're going to go, like, she knew, right? So I fly to India, and I loved it. It's chaotic. It's just like right up here, man. And it's And the people are amazing, and there's so much spiritual tradition. And we went to New Delhi, and we went to a Sikh temple, and we fed 2,000 people in one day. And they do that every day. Businessmen and poor people, because the businessmen don't want the poor people to feel bad, so they go have the free lunch to make them feel better. There's a humanity that happens over there that I started to realize I got to just let go and let India, right? Because weird stuff happens there. And we went up to Varanasi, the oldest city on earth, older than Athens. The holiest city in India. And we worked with the mentally ill there. And I got really into it. I went and visited some holy people I'd read about. And I did some amazing things. But I really wanted to get to Calcutta. I really wanted to go where to help Mother Teresa's hospice, because I have this relationship with death. And I wanted to bloom in it. I wanted to face things about myself. I'd watched both my parents die right in front of me. I'm getting older. I want to do these things. I want to be a maximum of service to clean this out, this vessel. And I got to Calcutta, and I got into this training for it. And I got 5 days in Calcutta, and I'm on the bus, and this little girl, Margarita, who's from France, she goes, "Hey, are you excited?" And I go, "I'm really excited about this." And she goes, "Okay, for the first 2 weeks, you work in the kitchen. And the next 2 weeks, you do the laundry. And then if you get an opportunity, you can work with the patients." And I got kind of sad. I said, "Oh, I'm just here for 5 days." And she goes, "Oh, you're going to do the dishes." But I knew then, let go. Let go and let India. Surrender. I'll do dishes. That's what I'm supposed to do. And I walk into this place, and I'm walking across the room, and Margarita speaks a little Hindi, and she's been there 6 months, and she tells him, new guy, right? And this guy comes over to me, and he starts to take me to the dishes, and this little tiny nun with the Mother Teresa sari, the blue on, grabs my arm, and she goes, "Hey, what's your name?" Tiny. She's like 4 feet tall. And I go, "My name's Matthew." And she goes, "Oh, are you a physical therapist?" I go, "No." She goes, "Are you a physical therapist today?" And I laughed and I go, "Sister, do you need a physical therapist?" And she said, "Well, not just anyone." And I swear to God, she said, "Have you ever worked with anybody that's paralyzed on one side of their body?" I swear to God. Surrender, grace, love. And I said, "I do it every day. My wife's been paralyzed for almost 20 years. And she said, "I knew that. There's no way she knew that." And she said, "Would you mind helping this person?" And I sat down, and I had the privilege of holding men while they died. And we undressed them, and Margarita and the girls came in, and we cleaned their bodies and put them in clothes. These people were so poor, we gave them what they had. The girl said, this one guy died. The next day I ran in, I was holding him while he died, and I said, "He wasn't here," and he passed away right in my arms. And I said, "Where was he, sister?" "He wasn't here." And she goes, "I found him in the night. We had an empty bed, and Mother taught us never let a man die with dignity or a woman die without dignity. We found him in the night a couple miles from here." And I said, "How'd you get him here?" This woman's like 80 years old. She's 4 feet tall. And she said, "Oh, I wear the robes of Mother. They carried him for me, the other people." And he said, "You know, Matthew, you just love that man more than anyone's loved him ever." And there was a peace. There was a place of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love, which I had thought myself incapable. And I got home, 24 hours of flying, after a month in India, and my wife is not reliable to pick me up at the airport. She has real bad memory issues because of her brain damage. So I 25 hours, I get in the car from the SeaTac, I drive over to Gig Harbor Airport, I park my car, I'm walking up the steps, and my wife walks out the door, and she says, "Oh my God, Matthew, you become younger. It's a way of life. It's amazing." Thanks.